1871 by the nuns. I was told they took a woodshop class in town to learn how to use a bandsaw and frame a house, etc. I've read that the number one thing to accomplishing a goal is choosing a goal that you deeply desire. I had amazing respect for the nuns for taking the initiative and accomplishing their goal. The house oozed of passion. Sister Cecilia greeted me at the door with her dog. I put my hand down low with my knuckles facing the dog's mouth just as I was taught. The dog sniffed my hand and then my ass. Apparently, he or she approved because the dog lay down for a belly scratch. I obliged. Sister Cecilia gave me a tour of the house and bakery. It felt like a very nice bed and breakfast, warm and inviting. There was carpet and it was super clean. Attached to the house was a fully equipped and operating bakery that looked like it belonged in any town, USA. When I asked her where she was from, she said, "I'm a Hoosier." Sister Cecilia is one cool nun. Two young women from the Divinity School at Yale joined us for lunch. They're staying with the sisters for a few days, and I saw them at the service this morning. One said she was from Oregon. "Oh, you're a duck." Sister Cecilia paused and looked over at me like I'd sinned. I guess she only knows the Big Ten. Before we got started, the two young women stood across from me in the dining room as we waited for lunch. I guess they're nuns in training or prospective nuns. I wasn't sure what to call them. But one of them seemed really angry. The other was sweet and angelic. I think the nice one was named Debbie. Since we were alone, I tried to make small talk. I figured they had to be friendlier than Lenny. But I wanted to be careful. I haven't seen my wife in over a week and have been sequestered with a bunch of 40 to 70-year-old men around the clock. I felt like these two gals haven't been around any men either. So I wanted to be clear about my intention, or maybe I should say lack of intention. I didn't want there to be any confusion I was attempting to flirt. "Hey, I'm Jesse. I'm married," I said, grabbing a glass of water off the table, "and have four kids. How are we all doing today? Good?" "Hi, married Jesse," the friendly nun in training said. "What are you doing here anyway?" the angry nun in training chimed in. "I'm what you call a guest, just visiting." And then Debbie started asking questions in a rapid-fire machine gun way. It was like she took the vow of silence, and I was the first human she could talk to. I couldn't keep up. "Have you found God? And I'm also curious, what authors inspire you? You can learn a lot about people that way. Have you surrendered your life to the Lord at a micro level? How long have you been here and what have you learned?"
"I've learned a lot," I said, trying to catch up. "I learn every day."
"Like what?"
I felt like I was on stage at the Miss America pageant. Like this was my final question to see if I had a chance at winning the crown. The way these young women were looking at me made me feel like I was being judged on my answer. I needed this to be good.
The irony in the word present. They both looked confused. I needed to avoid a Miss South Carolina response. If you're present in doing a task, it's like receiving a present. There's joy in everything we do, and being present is an integral part of it. Sometimes it can be difficult. Our minds like to wander. But if I just say out loud what I'm doing, I can always bring myself back to center, to be present. Like the other day, I was washing dishes and my mind was all over the place. I just said, "I'm washing dishes." And instantly, I was right back to where I needed to be, washing dishes.
"I'm not sure I'm following. Can you explain?"
We all have had moments where we are here, but not present. We miss a basket at our son's basketball game because we were checking Facebook. We live in a world where we can watch real-time events unfold all over the world live, yet we can't focus on where we are right now.
"I get that.
What else have you learned?" the nice one asked.
"That there's no lid to happiness. I can always improve."
"Can you feel religion and God all day?"
"Well, actually," I said, "there are really only two things going on up here, prayer
and labor. Religion and spirituality are a big part of it, but prayer is only in the morning and night. In between the two services is labor. So you only get the religious element twice a day, but that's only technically speaking because it does surround us. When the monks work, do they feel like God is steering them? I don't know, I said. Ask them. But I don't think so. I think they're just working. But they're doing God's work. No, I said. They're selling puppies to keep the lights on. I'm kidding. Well, sort of. I think they're in constant contact with God and searching for God's will. But the one thing I've noticed is that they have extreme passion for every task they do. Everything. I assume that's because it's their place. They're cutting their own grass. The other thing is nobody says no to the commitment to the community. Everyone is at dinner. Everyone is at the meeting. Everyone is at prayer. Is this experience everything you thought it would be? Interestingly enough, no, I said. Most of the spiritual traditions I assumed about the monastery aren't true. Not even close. My expectations were way off the mark. It hasn't been a series of mountaintop experiences where I felt free to explore my spirituality unobstructed by the hitches of daily life. It's a grind up here, too. Everyone is expected to contribute in a series of tedious duties. But there's regularity to it, and the monks hold that regularity sacred. There's really not much room for deviation. But it's been a great catalyst for personal transformation for me. I've learned that spiritual time doesn't have to be carved out. I can explore the spiritual life when I'm doing mundane, trivial work. The spiritual GoPro is always on the record setting. My greatest realization up here came when I was scrubbing the church floor. What was it? Every task is important. Every moment has purpose. Well then, what are you looking for? I'm not really looking as much as I'm experiencing. And we'll see what I get. I'm picking up valuable tips along the way. For example, the brothers know they have to live with each other, so they want to live in peace. How great is that? They've allotted time every week to communicate with each other and sort out any issues. It sounds simple, but an effort needs to be made. I'm going to institute that with my wife when I get home. It'll just mean more peace. Isn't that great?
I don't want peace, the angry one finally chimes in.
Well, the opposite of peace is turmoil, I said. You want turmoil?
No, I want truth, she said, pounding her fists on the table.
Debbie giggled a little. She seemed really sweet. How about you, I asked. What are you looking for? I've been trying to find a purpose, Debbie said. I'm looking for a sign, but I don't know because I keep waiting. I'm super focused on looking for it, but I just haven't found it yet. Maybe by looking for one thing, you miss out on everything else, I said. I've realized that just experiencing instead of having expectations and searching can sometimes be better. Just then, the three real nuns walked into the room. We all sat for lunch. I looked around the room and the realization I was eating lunch with three nuns, two nuns in training, and three German shepherds finally hit me. The only interaction I've ever had with a nun is watching Sally What's-Her-Name in The Flying Nun, a television show I watched as a kid staying home from school when I was sick. Or fake sick. Same thing. On the menu today was fish, which I don't eat, salad, polenta, and cauliflower. The polenta and vegetables were good. One of the sisters had heard I'd partnered with Warren Buffett in the jet business, so she told me she wasn't a fan of his. But I'm pretty sure she was talking about Jimmy Buffett. It's just a hunch. And then Sister Rebecca told me about a friend of hers who said she only had 3 years of work left, and then she was going to retire and do what she really wants to do for the rest of her life. Sister Rebecca felt bad for her because she already was doing exactly what she wanted every day of her life. Imagine all the time my friend lost not doing what she wanted to do. I agreed. So I told her a story about a friend of mine. He's turning 53 and is going through something of a change in his life.
Getting older can be a rude awakening. All of a sudden, the years have gone by and you haven't done nearly what you hoped to do. And the older you get, the faster the clock ticks. My friend was in one of those melancholy, what have I done with my life moods. So I said to him, what if I gave you $10 million? What would you do? That's easy. I moved to California first thing, he said. Well, guess what? Nobody's going to give you $10 million. But if you want to move to California, do it now.
Really?
Yes. Save up 6 months of cushion, move, and figure it out. Otherwise, you'll live with massive regret.
Did he move to California? Debbie asked.
Nah, he's still talking about it.
People are always waiting for something to happen before they change their lives. But they have it backward. When you change your life, big things are more likely to happen. One thing is for sure. If you keep waiting for someone to give you $10 million, nothing is going to change. The nuns and monks have it right. They made the big change in their lives years ago. And you know what would happen if someone gave them $10 million? Nothing. They wouldn't do a damn thing differently. And they'd stay perfectly happy. The takeaway is that money isn't the life changer. Quicksilver cash might upgrade the things in your life, but it does little to alter the course of it. Change costs no money at all. The younger you make decisions to live life on your terms and do what you love to do, the more fulfilling a life you'll live. And it's never too late. After the main course, lunch got weird. Debbie, the nice nun in training, announced she was confused. She grew up in the Georgia Bible Belt and had been told to dress modestly and to wait until she was married to have sex. But she's been hooking up with guys and wasn't sure how to balance it all. And then she asked, how do you women deal without sex? That's when I offered to leave and Sister Cecilia agreed it was probably a good time to go. Before I left, I surprised them with a gift of Atlanta Hawks t-shirts. Sister Patricia held hers up and asked for a medium. And then she asked who Millsap was. She thought it was an unusual name. I explained it was his last name and his first name is Paul. We wear our last names on our jerseys. Isn't that self-centered? If it's a team, why not only wear the team name and de-emphasize the individual? That made sense to me. Anyway, Paul, she said, he sounds religious. I'll have to check on that one. When I got back to the monastery, a great surprise was waiting for me. Under my door was a New York Post. Josh the cook snuck it in for me. He's hopefully going to do it every day. We sort of made a side deal. The deal was he'd try to get me a paper and I wouldn't die of boredom. Look, I'm over the hump of wanting to quit, but it's still not easy to be completely isolated. And I was looking forward to reading it. But Trump was pissed at someone. A white supremacist killed an African American on 9th Avenue. Terrorists killed 4 people in Europe. I threw it out before I even got to page 6's gossip. The day-to-day madness is not something I'm missing. In fact, I'm beginning to enjoy being away from it. Day 12. Fitting in. To find happiness, you must be exposed to things. Happiness is out there. It's your job to look. The Monks of Newski. When I walked outside to the church this morning, Lenny the intern sprinted past me. He stopped underneath the tower and begged Luke to let him ring the bells. Luke obliged. Lenny put on the huge protective headphones and started to wail on the bells. I slipped into the empty church and sat at my usual spot. The bells sounded louder than normal. I give Lenny credit. He played them like he was an Iron Maiden. Way to go, Lenny, I said when he entered, and I got my first smile from him. He looked truly happy.
After service, the two of us headed to breakfast. We didn't talk, but just walking together is a dramatic improvement in our relationship. When we entered into the dining room, Raisa and Verna, the German shepherds, stood at attention. They do this every time they see Lenny. I didn't get it. Not before today. Lenny's maybe the most antisocial person I know, but the dogs love him. I'm one of the most social people I know, and the dogs pay me no mind. I was starting to think Lenny was some kind of secret dog whisperer. We were allowed to talk at breakfast today, so I asked the monks if they could have dinner with three people who were alive, who would they choose? They immediately threw it back to me, but I was prepared. I told them how I was recently at a dinner party with 10 couples and was asked that very question. Most of the others at the party had already said the obvious choices, Gates, Oprah, Buffett, Obama, Musk, etc. But when it was my turn, my three choices were rappers. A few heads were scratched because they couldn't understand. But the reason I chose them was because these guys had an impact on me when I was 14 years old, and they changed the trajectory of my life. So I wanted to meet them and thank them. I wanted to ask how they mastered their craft and what their creative process was like. My angle was coming more from personal impact. That night, driving home with Sarah, I thought about it. Why not actually do it? So the next day, I invited 10 of the most influential artists in my life to my house for dinner. And 6 weeks later, they were all seated around my dinner table. My friends all asked me how I got them to come, and I said simply, I asked. Nothing happens without asking for it. Dinner was amazing. The similarities in their journey as musicians to mine as an entrepreneur were evident. For starters, they were so young when they started, they had no time to be scared. As someone starting out in business, getting over the fear of being embarrassed is one of the most liberating gifts you can give yourself. I don't like to be embarrassed. I don't think any of us do, but I'm not afraid of it. The dinner lasted well into the wee hours, and it was an incredible experience for me. I realize most people don't get to do something like that, so I felt incredibly fortunate. The monks loved the story and started throwing out the names of their wish list guests. All of the people were religious leaders and philosophers. They were the men and women who helped shape their own personal development during their journey. Then I asked if they had any interest in meeting anyone famous, and Brother Christopher said, "It doesn't matter what others are doing. It matters what you are doing." Amen. 10 a.m. So today's chore was grooming with Brother Luke and Lenny. After we ate, I did the dishes and headed out. The grooming center is connected to the whelping house where all the puppies are. I pushed open the door as I walked in and hit Lenny in the back. He was standing facing the wall, just standing there like he was frozen. It was like someone had put him in the corner. He didn't look well. So I immediately asked if he was all right. "No, all the barking is messing with my mind. Make it stop. I'm not okay." I didn't know what to do. He looked like he was ready to snap. So I told Brother Luke he had better come quick and help Lenny. Luke tugged Lenny by the arm and pulled him into the grooming room. It was like a scene out of a soap opera. He grabbed him and shook the crazy out of him, at least for the time being. Grooming, I learned, is an all-day event. With the three of us in there and two German shepherds, Shems and Khan, it was like the number 6 train at rush hour. There was nowhere to move. There's a big wooden table the dogs climb up on with a brush, nail clipper, sprayer, and everything else we needed within hand's reach. We started with Khan. He jumped on the table. "Plots," Brother Luke said to Khan. Khan immediately sat down. Apparently, the Nuski German shepherds are authentic. They speak perfect German. The monks keep a satellite radio in the grooming room, and Brother Luke flipped it on. Who knew? The dial was set to NPR. I'm not sure who was live, but it sounded like Terry Gross. And then Luke explained to us that the dogs love this station, and they also are into Gregorian chant music. Watching him with the dogs is like watching myself with my children. He's deeply connected and engaged. He loves them and enjoys caring for them so much. And the way the dogs respond to him is amazing. They love him just as much. Brother Luke doesn't raise dogs. He raises spiritual guides. But it was time to work, so he did all of the preliminary stuff like clipping and brushing while Lenny and I watched. And then he grabbed the electric filer and started trimming the dog's nails. Lenny and I were basically hugging each other at this point to give Brother Luke enough room to work. And since I was 2 inches from Lenny's face, I figured it was time to build on our relationship. I asked Lenny if he's a big fan of dogs. Obviously, I grew up with farm animals. But I thought he came from Vegas, and he was just flipping out a minute ago. When Luke finished Khan's haircut, it was Shem's turn. Our job was to keep Khan company while Shem got groomed. I wrapped my arms around the shepherd, but Lenny had like one finger on the dog and had moved as far away as he could. That's when Brother Luke started gushing about Lenny of how much the dogs love him. When we were done, Lenny couldn't wait to get out of there. Again, we went through the whelping room and there was a litter of pups. Brother Luke scooped one of them up and tried to hand it to me. I didn't want to take the puppy. What if I dropped him? What if he peed on me? What if he hated the way I smelled? But before I could say something, he was plopped into my hands. I held the little ball of fur close to my chest. The pup nuzzled in for the warmth. Its eyes were still closed. Their eyes don't open until they're 6 days old, so the puppy doesn't know who or what is holding it. Yet it's completely trusting. At first I felt a little uneasy holding the little fella. I was worried I was doing it wrong. But he melted into my chest and I began to pet him. Tonight at supper we had blueberries for dessert. And when we finished we all stood up to pray. Everyone had their heads down and eyes closed. Brother Christopher started to lead us. And as he spoke, I couldn't help it. I opened an eye to see if anyone else was looking. That's when I saw Lenny slipping Verna a blueberry underneath the table. And then he fed one to Shem's. He's bribing them. When I looked over again, Lenny's eyes were closed. It was like he's been deep in prayer the whole time. Dog whisperer my ass. Later, we all gathered in the reading room where they had an extra TV set up. It was movie night. When I first heard about it, I got really excited. I was thinking, Animal House and popcorn. What a great night. The monks have been raving about it all day, too. Jesse, are you excited for tonight? And only a few hours until the show starts. And big night. It's movie night. I headed over there about 5 minutes early, thinking I should try to get a good seat. But most of the monks were already there. I could tell they were genuinely excited to step away from work and prayer and disappear into a good film. I sandwiched myself between Stavros and Thomas on a tiny couch. After a few more minutes, everyone had arrived and it was time to press play. "I think you're going to like this," Stavros said. "It is part 9, but you shouldn't have any problems following along." "Oh, cool," I said. Now I was thinking it must mean it like the 9th episode of a series, which is fine by me. I'm just excited to escape and get some old-fashioned entertainment. But then Stavros explained we were watching a 14-part series about Christianity. Wait, what? That's got to be like a lawyer watching Law and Order or a doctor watching Grey's Anatomy. Wouldn't they be tired of watching what they do all day? "We started in November," Stavros added. "We'll be done with the programming by the summer." Okay, this gives new meaning to binge-watching. It's going to take them over 6 months to finish this series, and once the opening credits rolled, I knew why. It was so boring. I couldn't follow the plot if There was a plot. Regardless, nothing was making sense. I tried. I really tried. I focused on the screen, but it was like watching a foreign film without subtitles. And yet, this is the only thing available to watch. Meanwhile, when I'm at home, I get frustrated sometimes with too much content. I spend an hour clicking around Netflix, Hulu, and Amazon, but never make a decision. It's like I go window shopping instead of actually consuming entertainment or something educational. I just keep clicking. But here at the monastery, it's like 1977. Growing up, we had basically three channels to choose from, and if we wanted to change the channel, we actually had to get up off the couch, walk to the television, and manually turn the knob. And if Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan was delivering a speech, forget about it. That was an 8-year-old's worst nightmare. Three stations and only one choice? That was frustrating. As I bounced between 2017 and 1977 in my head, I thought about Goldilocks and the Three Bears. Strange, right? But in the fairy tale, Goldilocks tries three chairs, three bowls of porridge, and three beds. And each time she finds her third choice to be just right. She keeps trying until she finds something that works for her. Just right. Maybe I should be more like Goldilocks. Keep trying things until it's just right. After about 10 minutes of trying to follow the monk's entertainment choice, I looked around the room. And all of the monks were enthralled. They looked like my kids watching Finding Nemo. They were hooked. Even Lenny seemed entertained. He was sitting on the edge of his seat like he was watching the final episode of Homeland. I looked over at Raisa and Shems lying on the floor. The two dogs looked back at me like they were asking for help. They were just as bored as I was. I smiled. And then they both slowly got up and walked over to me. They laid next to my feet. Raisa turned her neck and looked up. I rubbed her belly. And then Shems, not wanting to miss out on any of the affection, positioned himself to get the dual belly rub going. Would Sarah kill me if I brought a dog home? Day 12 is a wrap, but I feel different, like I have a new perspective. So here I was, fully aware of the contrast that took place on this day. It started with me talking about having 10 influential rappers at my house for dinner, and then witnessing two of the most mundane activities that occur at the monastery, the grooming of the dogs and the wildly boring viewing of the movie. Could I really be content with the mundane? Could I find enlightenment and value in similar activities once I got back to Atlanta? Day 13. 35,000 decisions. When you talk, you are only repeating what you already know. But if you listen, you may learn something new. Dalai Lama. Monotasking has become second nature to me. I enjoy washing dishes and cleaning floors. It's amazing how much better my production is when I focus solely on one task. There's no race anymore. I finish when I finish. I finish when the job is done. That's one thing I'm picking up here at the monastery. The monks have eliminated most of the self-imposed deadlines that we all put on ourselves daily. Rather, they've shifted their focus to emphasize the quality of their work. They finish when their job is thoroughly done, and then, and only then, are they finished. That attitude favors a no-cutting-corner style, and the end result is always much better. Everything around here is improving for me as well. I know when to stand, kneel, and sit during service. I'm starting to learn the prayers and find myself singing along. It feels good to sing in church. When I get home, I want to have the family sing together on Sundays. The monastery is beginning to feel like my second home. Yesterday, a visitor asked me when the service started, and after I told them, they said, "Thank you, brother." That's right, Brother Jesse, at your service. I'm in the groove. I'm feeling
Monktastic. I'm also thinking super clearly and a new wave of creativity has hit me. I think I know why. The average American makes something like 35,000 decisions a day. I read somewhere that we make so many decisions it can cause a condition called decision fatigue. Ever wonder why late in the game your quarterback decides to throw a pass into triple coverage? Or just before bedtime you decide to let your kid have a candy bar? Or after a hard day's work you think it's a good time to tell your significant other they might have put on a couple of pounds? Decision fatigue. It hits us all. But here at the monastery, virtually all my decisions have been removed. I eat. When the monks tell me to eat, I eat whatever they serve. I don't have to choose from a lot of clothing. I've only worn two outfits. We don't realize that our daily decisions take up so much space in our heads. There's no room left for creativity and more productive thought. With most decisions off my plate now, my brain is flooded with clear thoughts. I went to my room today and organized my entire life into a few short lists. I broke my life into four buckets: family, work, personal, and wellness. And then I filled each category with what I want to accomplish. I saved them on my phone. I also feel like I'm reconnected to my gut and the forces re-entering my body. My instincts are starting to come alive. I'm glad I stayed. I spoke with Sarah today on the monk's landline. It was great to hear her voice and get an update on the kids. You know, just the usual four young children carnage and chaos. I feel bad she has to pick up so much slack while I'm gone. I'm going to have to figure out a way to make it up to her. Right after we spoke, I meditated again. Drum roll, please. I made it 20 minutes without looking at the clock. My mind only wandered a few times, and I was able to immediately bring myself back. I went up to Brother Christopher after service today. He spent much of his time talking about anxiety and worrying. While listening to him throughout my journey, I've realized how tense my body was. And this wasn't just in the moment. It was all the time. My shoulders have always been really tight, and I've tried everything from chiropractors to professional masseuses walking on my back. Nothing has ever worked. Today, for the first time in years, that pain and tightness went away. "Thank you," I said to Brother Christopher. "Your words really resonated with me. I don't have so much to worry about in my life, but it seems like I still worry."
"Well, most of us feel overwhelmed. It's usually with things of no real significance," he said.
"What do you mean?"
"We think about things that may happen, everything that can go wrong, and we obsess. Most of the concerns are self-imposed."
I started to go through the checklist of worries on my mind. What if my kids don't do well at school? What if I get sick before the marathon I've been training for? What if my hair doesn't grow back?
"So, is it possible to not be anxious?" I asked.
"Well, we all know super inspiring people who live in the midst of tragedy, but still live with peace. Pope Francis, who lived in the slums of Argentina, and concentration camp survivors from the Holocaust are great examples. They know suffering deeply, but were not robbed of peace."
"Wow. Is there a formula or a blueprint that allows us to be peaceful without turning off our heads?"
"Yes," he said. "Meditating on scripture, grounding us against whatever threatens us in life. God's words can speak to us and touch us personally if we read a passage multiple times."
I'm not at all religious, but his message still made sense. We kept talking, and I learned that 90% of the things we worry about never come to fruition. That isn't a very good return on your investment. Obviously, the answer isn't not to worry at all, but we need to keep in check the things out of our control. If we spend too much time worrying about things that might happen, we'll miss out on all the things we can improve in our lives.
I also spent time with Brother Gregory in the monk's gift shop. It was just like two old friends chatting. And then Brother Thomas popped up out of nowhere. I've come to realize that monks might be world-class hide-and-seek players. They're always popping up out of nowhere. I thanked them and told them how it's been an amazing experience for me so far. You all have been so welcoming to me, and I really appreciate it. It's been amazing to watch the love that you guys have for each other, the sense of family, and the tremendous work ethic. Well, thank you. No, thank you. You followed your heart and created the life you wanted to live. And with no focus on money, ego, or competition, you've been able to find deep happiness, love, and gratitude. That is a powerful lesson to take home.
We've gained more than we gave, Brother Gregory said. We'll miss your energy.
It made me feel good. He gave me some meditation and prayer books and How to Be Your Dog's Best Friend and The Art of Raising a Puppy, two of the monk's best-selling dog training books. He put them in a bag and handed them to me with a warm handshake. A few hours later, Brother Christopher popped his head into my room to check on me. The prayer service wasn't for another 2 hours, so he asked what I was going to do until then.
Think, I said. I'm comfortable being alone.
I sat between Brother Christopher and Brother Stavros for our nightly meal. I'm leaving the monastery tomorrow because I committed to do a podcast in Manhattan. So it was like my last supper. They told me they were impressed I made it this long. I am too. 13 days, 120 miles up and down the driveway, 50 hours of religious services, meditating an hour a day the best I can. Brother Christopher told me that someone had come up to the monastery for a planned stay and only lasted 6 hours. The visitor told the monks that the silence got to him, and if he stayed there any longer, he might freak out. They weren't even sure if he unpacked. It makes me think back to my first day. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I thought there'd be 50 bald monks walking around in robes and sandals in complete silence. Right before I went to bed, I asked Brother Stavros what he missed most about life on the outside. He said, the screened-in porch in Georgetown where he grew up. 50 years and the only thing Stav misses is a porch? Wow. He said he can still smell the grass and flowers like it was yesterday. It makes me wonder what I'll miss in 25 years. The difference in how we perceive time is mad. 50 years in the monastery went by like a shot for him. For me, the 2 weeks feels like a year. I recently told Sarah that I wanted to throw a big party in August for my 50th birthday. I explained that when I turned 25, I had a big bash in New York City as I thought 25 was monumental, and now I wanted to do the same. Think about all that happened to you in the past 25 years, all that you've accomplished in that time, Sarah said. Honestly, sweetie, I don't think I've accomplished anything. I want to do so much more in my life. My biggest enemy is the clock. Well, what have you enjoyed the most over those years? The challenges, adventures, and doing things with the people I love. Honey, then put as much of that on your plate as you can over the next 25 years. Time is going fast. Load your plate up with the things you love to do. Roger that. Anyway, I'm excited for tomorrow. I'm not packing for good because I want to come back to the monastery and see how I feel. New York City, here I come. Days 14 and 15. Re-entry. Back to the madness. In the midst of movement and chaos, keep stillness inside of you. Deepak Chopra. In the morning, right on time, Alfredo came to pick me up. Alfredo is our regular driver when Sarah and I are in New York. He's been with us for so long, we would mourn if he ended up switching careers or moving away. We love him. He drove up the driveway going about 2 miles per hour.
Alfredo never drives at 2 miles per hour. As he got closer, I could see his face through the windshield. He was looking around like he had just driven through some magical portal and entered into a mystical land. It was like he just found himself in a Disney movie, enchanted and lost in his own world. I waved, but couldn't get his attention. Once he parked, I rolled my bag over. "Man," he said, opening his car door, "is anyone alive up here?" "This is how it is all the time," I said. "We're in the boonies." "Nah, man, nah," he said. "This isn't the boonies. This is the loonies. Did you bring any smoothies?" He flashed the smile of a drug dealer and popped the trunk. I threw my bag in. When we got in, he pulled out a bag of 4 grown man smoothies. I finished the first one before we even buckled up. I've been trying to convince myself that the monastery food was great, but after a few sips, I remembered how much I love smoothies. Alfredo slammed the shift into drive and pulled out of the parking lot. I silently gazed out of my window as we drove away. It was pleasantly quiet, with the only sound being the snow and branches that crunched underneath our tires. As I gazed out the window, I began to feel a little sad. I'd walked the monk's private road dozens of times, but now, as I was leaving, I realized just how beautiful it was. Eventually, Alfredo broke the silence. "How long have the monks been here?" he asked. When I told him, he was shocked. "Impossible," he said. "Come on, man. 50 years? As we got to the bottom of the hill, we rolled past the 2 mobile homes and the dogs went nuts as usual. Alfredo stomped on the gas and we peeled out of Monk Road. Immediately, I spotted 2 bike riders, and it was like seeing the ocean for the first time. I couldn't believe it. Humans! Real, non-monk, humans! I kept my eye on them until they disappeared from view. The plan was to stop at my Connecticut house on the way back to New York City to pick up my friend Mike Young. Mike is a movie director and he's like family to us. Last April, he asked if he could stay with us for a short weekend in our apartment in Manhattan while looking for a place to rent. He was shooting a film and his production company was in the process of finding him a spot to bunk while filming. I'm not sure what happened to the rental because he stayed in our apartment for 5 months. My son Laser thinks Mike is his real uncle. Mike's also a stand-up comic and one of the funniest guys I know. He once told me this joke. Guy's on a job interview and the interviewer says to him, "What's your worst attribute?" And the guy says, "I'm brutally honest." And the interviewer says, "I don't think that's a bad attribute." And the guy says, "I don't give a fuck what you think." I was really looking forward to seeing Mike. I needed a laugh. The farther we got away from the monastery, the more I realized I was back in the world I'd left. As I watched the trees, mile markers, and road signs flash by, a feeling of inner happiness came over me. I felt different, lighter. I could see my reflection in the window, and there was a smile on my face. I was proud of myself for sticking it out and being open to such a different experience. Eventually, we pulled into my driveway in Connecticut. Alfredo and I had said very few words to each other, and that's not usually the case, and he was looking at me oddly. "You okay?" he asked. "I don't think I've ever been better." Mike piled into the car and we headed to the city. It was great to get caught up, but as soon as we hit the interstate, Mike pulled out his phone. He started scrolling text messages, emails, and social media. I was watching him try to do all 3 at once. Then he started making phone calls on speaker. He kept firing through his emails as he talked to a manager about upcoming gigs. He was doing 9 things at once and none of them like a monk. "You should try monotasking," I said. He wasn't listening, just texting and carrying on a conversation on speaker. You could get a headache watching him. Actually, I kind of did, and then laughed as he continued texting. I really started to notice the traffic when we were about 20 miles outside of the city. We were bumper to bumper and everyone was late for something. I imagine everyone was thinking about their next stop, next meal, or next whatever. You could see it on the faces of the drivers. The traffic only got worse. New York is like an ant farm. We climb all over one another. It took us about an hour to get to my hotel in Midtown. After Alfredo dropped me off, he was taking Mike to a friend's apartment further downtown. I wondered if he'd stay there for 5 months. The New York City sidewalks felt like one of those conveyor belts for people in airports. I stood there watching people and pets glide by, some coming, some going, everyone on the move, everyone gliding. I was about to grab my bag when, bam, I got blindsided, pow, knocked right to the ground. And when I looked up, I saw a middle-aged guy in a suit looking down at his phone. We just went shoulder to shoulder, and he didn't even look up. It was like he was a bumper car at the carnival and just kept going, 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 and going. Wow, I said to myself. Was I ever that guy? For dinner, I got takeout from Rosa Mexicano. I ordered 2 meatless entrees, a main course vegetable plate, an order of the guacamole that they're famous for, and 3 corn on the cobs. I had the television on ESPN while I was stuffing my face. I was eating like a gorilla. I couldn't stop shoveling food into my face. My pace didn't slow down until I started on corn on the cob number 3. Meanwhile, I found myself clicking from ESPN to Sports Channel to Yes and back to ESPN. But after 14 days without it, TV felt like an invasion to my senses. The announcers were talking about trades, games, stats, and highlights at a rapid pace. I snapped it off and enjoyed the rest of my vegetable plate in silence. I wondered how quickly I'd slip back to my bad habits. How long would it take for my old life to swallow me whole? It might have already. By 9 o'clock, I was exhausted. I sat in the comfortable chair in my hotel room and began to meditate. As I started my rhythmic breathing, I could hear every sound. A distant car horn from the street, footsteps in the carpeted hallway, a faint electronic buzz coming from the clock on the table next to the bed. Soon, I heard nothing but the rush of air in and out of my lungs. Every day at the monastery, my meditation practice became stronger. By the end of 14 days, I was able to clear my mind for 10, 15 minutes, even more. I think about how an entire generation of kids has been prescribed drugs for ADHD when many might be better off if they learn to meditate. Now, I know some kids need the medication that doctors prescribe, but all medication has a potential downside. Meditation has no downside. Worst case is you'll miss 15 minutes of television. The next morning, I woke up early without an alarm. I slipped out of bed and went to the bathroom. In the mirror, I got a good look at myself for the first time in 2 weeks. I must have lost 15 pounds at the monastery. With my scraggly beard and emaciated body, I looked like Tom Hanks in Castaway. I washed my face and brushed my teeth. And when I made my way back to bed, I instinctively went to cover my ears. The bells! And then I looked at my phone. Yep, it was 7:15 a.m. Wow, I have an internal clock. My thoughts shifted to the monks filing into the church. I wondered if they were looking over at my empty pew. The hotel I was staying at wasn't far from Central Park, so I decided to walk the 6-mile park loop. It felt right to walk, not run. The bellhop opened the door and I re-entered the chaos. There were beeping taxis, dump trucks backing up, and a street noise soundtrack playing in the background. It was coming from everywhere, surround sound. Almost every single person was on their phone. I guess I've noticed that before, but never as clearly. Now I was on high alert for someone to bump into me. I navigated my way to the opening of the park without any more injuries. On my walk, I popped into the old building where Sarah and I used to live on Central Park West. As I did, I saw Carlton, one of the doormen. "Hey, man," I said, "how are you?"
"Can I help you?"
Carlton asked. "Nah," I said, "I'm here just to say hi."
"Hi to who?"
"To you," I said. "Hi, Carlton."
"Hi," he said.
It dawned on me that he had no idea who I was. He never seen me bald or with a beard. "It's Jesse."
"Holy shit," he said. "I didn't even recognize you."
We chatted it up for a bit, and then he asked what I was doing. He wanted to know if I was okay. He kept asking, "Are you okay? Are you okay?" And the truth was, I felt great. Really great. After about 5 minutes, I took off and went to see my friend, Brian Freed. Brian's been one of my closest friends forever. Sarah calls him one of my super friends. I used to run with a group of friends in the park every Wednesday, and we called our group the Wonderful Wednesdays. But Sarah called us the Super Friends, and he's part of that crew. I hadn't seen Freed in a while, and I was really looking forward to catching up. I wanted to share my experience at the monastery. It was a nice 5-minute walk to where he was waiting for me in the sheep meadow where we planned to meet. When I saw him, I strolled up with a big smile, but he gave me the Heisman. He was deep into a conversation on his phone. "One second," he mouthed. "Love you, brother, but I have to take this call." Brian was a finance guy, but wasn't happy. He quit and started his own specialty contracting business. He had no prior experience or expertise in his new trade, but he followed his instinct and had the confidence he'd figured it all out if he just started. I'm super proud of him for that. He called me up when he was first putting the business plan together.
"I want to call it Elite Closets."
"You're only doing closets?"
"No, we're going to put in cabinets, shelving, and lots of other stuff."
"Name sounds like you only do closets."
"Yeah, I guess it does. I've been thinking of making a change."
I suggested Woodmasters, so to not pigeonhole him into just a closet company. He agreed, and Woodmasters was born. And from the looks of it, they were super busy. Even from a few feet away, I could tell he was putting out a fire. Then he rested the phone between his neck and shoulder and whispered that he'd be off in a minute. I sat on the bench and watched. He paced back and forth. It sounded like he was arguing with someone. Finally, he motioned me to come with him. I got up and we started walking the lower loop. Eventually, he ended the call and stopped to give me a hug. "Wow," he said, stepping back and looking at me. "Are you okay?"
"I'm good, man," I said. "I'm good. You look kind of scrawny."
His phone rang. He looked at the caller ID and picked it up.
"I'll call you back in 20, he said and clicked off.
As soon as he hung up, the phone rang again. As I watched him, I was looking at so many of our lives. That's how we operate all day long. As far as picking a place to re-enter the human race after a monastery stay, Manhattan might not have been the best choice. In no time, I felt the peace I accumulated leaking out of me like steam from a radiator. And I wasn't helping matters. My podcast started at 2:45 and I was pitching a business idea to Samsung on a conference call at 1:30. And in between, I wanted to go for steam. Too much to do, but the steam was non-negotiable. Once Brian and I completed the lower loop, we said our goodbyes. Alfredo picked me up with Mike Young in the car around 1:15 and we headed to the bathhouse. I figured I'd take the Samsung call in the car to give me the most sauna time possible. But the call went late, and by the time I got off, it was after 2:00. "We're going to have to speed sauna," I said to Mike. The Russian and Turkish baths have been around since the 1890s. It's now owned by two Russian guys, Boris and Dave, who had a fierce argument years ago and have had nothing to do with each other ever since.
Rather than sell the bathhouse after their fight, they decided to divide the club into two groups. If you buy a membership with Dave, you can't go on Boris days. And if you buy one from Boris, you can't go on Dave's. If you're neutral, like me, you just buy day passes and you can go anytime. The place is dirty, but it's what I like to call clean dirty. Just clean enough to pass code. The bathhouse is really one of a kind, and over the years it has drawn its share of celebs. Frank Sinatra was a regular customer, as was John Belushi, who once said it was the only place he could find peace. It's down in the basement of an old tenement building. There's no air. And once you check in, they give you paper shorts to wear and topless women walk around, but it feels totally normal. Today, you're just as likely to be sharing a sauna with a Ford model as with an 80-year-old Russian Jewish guy or a Brooklyn boxer looking to lose weight. Like Belushi, I go to the baths just to get away from the rat race for a while. Plus, I like to play a game to test my mental toughness. I pretend the sauna is a competition to see who can last the longest. Now, I'm not talking about your average Equinox or LA Fitness sauna box. They call the hot sauna at the 10th Street Baths the Russian Radiant Heat Room. It feels illegally hot. New York state law stipulates that a sauna cannot be over 175 degrees, but the one at the Russian and Turkish Baths seems at least 20 degrees hotter. It's so hot that when you exit the sauna, you have to walk in slow motion to the door or your skin will feel like it's burning off. Mike and I walked into the Radiant Room in our paper shorts and the scorching heat immediately attacked our skin. Holy shit. It's hot as fuck in here, Mike said. There were two other dudes in there. A super fit actor guy who looked like he belonged in a soap opera role and a thick Russian with tattoos, a beard, and a felt hat. He was wearing a hat. Right away, I knew who my competition was for the who will leave the sauna first game. I was right. After about 6 minutes, the actor guy started mumbling and poured a bucket of ice water over himself. It didn't help. He was out the door moments later. I wasn't really worried about Mike Young either. As expected, a minute later, he said, "Yo, Jay, this is brutal. I'm gonna go jump in the cold plunge," which left just me and the Russian. Mano a mano. This Russian dude was focused. He was staring at his feet in silence as the sweat dripped like a hose from his forehead. It was like the bathroom faucet was leaking from between his eyes. Drip, drip, drip onto the wood bench of the sauna. He was unwavering, just staring down at his sandals. I tried to meditate and get my mind off of the Russian and the heat. I wanted to win. But meditation in the Radiant Room was impossible. I'm not sure if a master monk could have handled the heat. It felt like my eyelids were melting. Meanwhile, the Russian started grunting rhythmically, like doing some type of tribal sauna breathing technique to extend his time. It sounded like it was coming from a place of strength, not weakness. I needed to pull some type of maneuver or I was going to lose. I figured I couldn't stand more than 2 more minutes. I better try to get him out of his trance soon. So I went for it. "Pretty hot, huh?" I said, trying to get him out of his zone and bring the heat to the forefront of his attention. He stopped grunting and looked right at me. With his felt hat and beard, he looked like he should be riding a camel in the Sahara. "Nah, my friend, it's not pretty hot," he said with a Russian accent. "It's fucking hot in here." This guy was a sauna beast. "How long do you stay in here?" I asked. "Until I can't fucking take it anymore." "Got it. Well, can I ask what the hat is for then?" "The hat? Oh, it's so the fucking roots of my hair don't burn off." "The roots of your hair?
Yes, the heat will rise. Your head is up high. Your fucking roots are on your head.